got myself a good job. Mm-hmm. I worked there for 8 years. 50 cents a week. 50 cents a week, but you had to base skirts, you know, on lining. We'd come about 8 o'clock and come home at 6 o'clock. I knew how to sew by machine from Italy as a little child because mother, she used to send me to the dressmaker after school, and I knew how to sew by machine. So when the slow season came to put lining on skirts, I says to the boss there, why don't you let me sit down by machine and work on by machine? He says to me, oh, his wife, she says, Ma, she says, you know how to sew by machine? I says, sure, I do. So I started to sew by machine. I got myself another job downtown, and I was only a little over 14. I told them I was 15, because otherwise they wouldn't take me. And there I worked for 8 years till I got married.
You give me United States anytime. America is my country, and this is where I stay. But I would rather spend my money right here in this country. Why? Because this is the country that gives you the living. There's no other country that'll give you a living. No other country. I doubt it. This is how I feel about it. You give me this country anytime. And I only became really a citizen about 20 years ago. I'm now 79.
This official there liked him very much and had said to him, look, if you feel that you're not earning enough money, and if you'd like to better your life, perhaps, you know, I can help you gain access to an entrance into the United States. He explained to him that there was a heavy depression in the United States. However, since he was a well-liked man and a very resourceful person, he was sure that he would be able to make it. And to this day, Mr. Augusto feels that he has never let that gentleman down, that he has used all the tools at his resource, and that he has earned his daily bread and continues to do so. And he gives thanks to this nation for allowing him to do so. He worked his way here in a ship. This ship had a load which was primarily that of sugar. After the ship, he got a job working in the subways and on the tracks. From 1929 to 1942, after working in the subway, he learned plumbing and he went to work in the Navy Yards. He had gotten married in Puerto Rico before he came to the United States. He left his wife behind. He did not send for her until he started working in the subway. About a year and 3 months went by from the time that he left her and came to the United States and the time that he was able to send for her. His second wife died
too,
as well as the first. Both of them died, and then he remarried, and now he has 4 children by the third wife. He has a daughter by the name of Blanca, who is now in line for a judgeship position. She's studying law. He feels very proud of the fact that even though he has not been able to learn how to read or write, he was able to provide his children with good, sound educations. Yes, nine children. No, right. Yeah. Having come to the United States was the turning point in his life. The point at which he began to gain some measure of success.
I am from a very poor family from birth. My mother and father was very poor. They gave me an education. And I was very much interested for a secondary education, but due to their poverty, they just couldn't make it with me. Finally, at a very young age, I got married. I'm a mother of 6 children. I worked very hard. I tried to help my husband the best I can. My husband's sister knew my problems, and she encouraged me to come here to the United States of America. My sister-in-law took me around all over the place, and I get to like the United States of America. My children, I got one here with me, but in the future, they're definitely sure my kids will be here with me. If God help me and I should get a good job, where I should get some money where I can save, because sponsoring for my family, I must have a savings to show a bank statement. I must have a good job where I can support my family, have an apartment where I can accommodate my family, and which means time. And I'll be just too happy. With you kind people help, I wish I should be successful in Florence Nightingale Hospital. Small as it is, I'll be thankful. As for me personally, I don't show nobody a sulky face. If anybody tell me hello, regardless to who you are, I will say hello. I know how to move around. I learned that. And when you have self-respect and certain amount of self-responsibility and dignity about yourself, you will get through. I am happier here. And since I am happier here as a mother of my kids, I'm sure when my kids come here, they will be happier. Because they can get everything they need here. Because here you can get something to do. Although I'm not doing something now, but I live in hopes. You understand? And I do hope I will be successful. And here, what you can get to buy, what you can get to eat with the money that you're working for, you can afford to buy it. Because back home, there is one price. Poor buy the same, the rich have to buy the same. You, the poor man who don't have the money, cannot buy it. But here, there are prices to suit the poor ones, there are prices to suit the middle class, and there are prices to suit the high class. So therefore, every person can live. That is it. I highly appreciate United States. I can live all the days of my life here.
I was a great one for geography at school, and we did North America for a whole year. And I don't know, it's because I come probably from such a small island, the vastness of it, I couldn't even imagine. You know, I'd like, next summer, when I'm traveling, I'd like to go maybe to Texas or somewhere and stand in a huge, desolate, desertous area and feel it there, you know? I want, this is sort of like freedom of nature is what I want in myself, really. And the wheat plains and the forests, and it's so enormous. I just want to be part of it and know what it's like.
I was born out in Montebello, which is a suburb of Los Angeles, and I didn't come into contact with any white Caucasian people until I was at age of four. Until I was age four, I was brought up to speak and converse in Japanese only. But having moved to the city, I found it very difficult since I had no knowledge of spoken English. Well, of course, when Pearl Harbor did happen, we were very confused. We didn't know what was in store for us in the future. But from the outpour of all our friendly customers, we thought we may be able to continue our business for at least an indefinite period of time until the order came down from the War Department about our curfews, and we restricted us to movements and certain hours that we could be out. And then, of course, came the evacuation notice, which, in fact, forced us out of business. My parents, by virtue of the Exclusion Act, and they wanted to become citizens and naturalized, but they were not permitted to become naturalized at that time. So they were still citizens. They retained the citizenship with the Japan. And naturally, the war being with Japan, they expected this kind of treatment. But they could not understand why the American citizens, like myself, were forced to go into the camps. One of the very primary things that we have to look out for is we were denied our freedoms given to us under the Constitution. All right, they said it was in the time of war and an emergency, and they tried to tell us that we were doing this for your, what we call protective custody. We're trying to keep the the bad people from getting at you. And so we're putting you away so they can't reach you, which in fact is not true. We were forced into these camps by I'm sure economic pressures. People thought this was a fine opportunity to get this competition out of the way. Camp life was not what it was put up to be. As I say, we were restricted as to our movements. We were incarcerated in these camps, which were fenced in by barbed wires. They had towers on each corner with searchlights, and they had manned machine guns with soldiers. And it was really like a concentration camp. We tried to, the camp that I was in housed 19,000 people, and they took over the Santa Anita racetracks and converted that with army barracks into living quarters. So you can imagine what it was like living in the stable areas where they once kept horses. The stench was really bad. Then they had to set up these barracks on the parking lots. There were many problems, sanitation problems. We had problems with the cesspools running over. The problems were going down and having your place, your clothes laundered. On the whole, the Japanese people are fastidious people. They like to keep themselves very clean and neat. And so bathing became a big problem. I think they picked the worst spots to set up these camps because it was part desert, and they ringed off the whole area, and then they leveled off the ground and set up these the houses, prefab houses. Life in these camps was also self-government, and I think the professional people were paid something like $19 a month. I think the scale was 19, 16, and 12. $19, $16, and $12 a month. In other words, like a doctor received 19, a lawyer, you see, according to his professional status. You stayed in the camps until you made a move to go out. In order to get out of the camps, you had to get, in my instance, I had to have a pledge of employment. In other words, I just couldn't come out and look. I had to have a job offered to me. So in order to come to the East Coast, where I eventually relocated, I had to have an Eastern Coast, Eastern Defense Command, an FBI command, FBI clearance. Someone had to, from the outside, you'd correspond and hopefully someone would tell you that the job was available. In my case, I had a friend who was in the flowers business and said a job was available, so I came out. I don't know how many people just remained in the camps until they were forced out. They had no place to go, eventually the government closed down the camps. I don't know what happened to the people who were there.
I knew that there was sweatshops, I knew there was exploitation, but I knew that people had a chance to get rich, and that they had such things that in this country, in Russia, we didn't have, that you made a lot of money, that your education is free, and I expected luxuries which in Europe I didn't have, and I knew education was free.
My mother came to the States in the 1920s on an arranged marriage with my father. Interestingly, however, my mother, for what reason I've never been able to understand, given her background, she arrived in New York, and her first impression of New York was one of enormous enthusiasm, which has always struck me as very odd, because she came from a peasant village that was very primitive, never went to any of the urban centers in Greece, was never in Athens, but came directly, essentially, from this peasant village into New York. And the minute she arrived in New York, she loved the skyscrapers, she was enthused that there was so much activity, and she was just exhilarated at being away from this restrictive village.
So they cultivated English. My mother especially went to night school to try to learn English. reading English was a little difficult for them, so they read the Yiddish paper, the Jewish Daily Forwards. And when they got here, also, and I'll never be sure that they really believed this, they had been told that in America the streets were literally paved with gold. But when they got here and got to work in the shops, the garment shops of that period, they found themselves working from sunup to sundown, 16 hours a day. It was real sweatshop stuff. Their feelings about America remained very mixed. On the one hand, they were very proud of the fact that they were in a country, or very proud is the wrong word, they were very happy to be in a country which was free.
I was born in Algeria 28 years ago. I was born in an upper middle class family. My father was a lawyer. He'd just come back from the war, where he'd been some kind of hero. He was a successful lawyer. He had two children, my brother and myself. And we stayed in Algeria until I was about 15, when this was time of independence, the war. We left for Paris, and a few years later, I was studying engineering in France at L'École des Mines. The top of the school typically went to the States, so I applied to three or four universities, and Columbia offered me a scholarship, which was the reason why I came. I knew I was going to have to transfer to a permanent resident visa, and that there was a chance that it would be refused. So I started asking my girlfriends if they would want to marry me if I was stuck without a visa, and of course I got horrified answers of no, it's ridiculous, and so on. But anyway, I had found ways of convincing people to do it if it was necessary. It was rather depressing to have to resort to such an idiotic personal, you know, having to change your personal life in order to just stay in a country, but I was willing to do it because I thought it was worth it to me, you know, that I didn't really want to go back. I had to swear that I was not a communist, that I had never joined a communist organization, that I didn't have VD, that I had never touched marijuana or even heard of it, that I didn't intend to overthrow the government of the United States, that I was a good boy, that I was clean, a whole series of things. I didn't have any mental diseases.
My parents are from Mexico, you know, Spanish immigrants. My father came into the United States, I think he was 25 or 30. And my mother was, she was born. It's a small little town just on the other side of the border. The border is San Luis, Sonora. And she went to the school up to the eighth grade, but all through her life, you know, she couldn't go to school too much because they would always be traveling, you know, like they'd start down in Arizona and they worked their way up, you know, through California and all the way up to Northern California. And they wouldn't have a house to stay. They would, you know, like they would put up a tent, you know, wherever they stopped that night, that would be the home for the night, you know, and they wouldn't know they'd be there for a week or two, you know. And my father was, he first came into the United States, he wasn't, you know, he was what you consider a wetback. He came in and he worked, you know, 5 or 6 years. Between the United States and Mexico, it's usually a big barbed wire fence that they have, and they cross this fence during the night, you know, mostly. Well, a lot of people can get into the United States with a visa, you know, it's a paper saying that they can come into the United States for a week to visit. And a lot of these people, what they do is they use this paper to come in and then they stay and they work. Here in the United States, it seems to be like a rat race, you know, like everybody wants to be making money, and that's all they worry about is their money. See, I have to, work and help my parents out. It's, you know, they say that the days of the slaves are over, but it's not so, you know. Because if you go back and you look the way that people live in California, you look at the shacks they live in, the conditions. You know, here in New York, you see, you know, they've got big apartments, you know, you go to Park Avenue and all this. But if you go back in California, you drive out in the country, you know, you see a, you know, a shack that, you know, the strong wind would come along and would blow it down. And, you know, a restroom that's outside is just a hole in the ground.
I came to the United States and I decided to continue in my profession. I went back to school in 1943, and in spite of the fact that I didn't know the language and I had financial difficulties, I had the most pleasant memories from my studying in Boston. When I think about the difference in this, the whole atmosphere, in the attitude of the people between Poland and the United States, it is something that only people who lived before in Europe and went through all the hardship can appreciate these things. I felt that I am free to go where I want. I felt that I don't have to carry always with me my passport, my identification. I can express my opinion if I disagree with somebody. And I became very much interested in American politics, in American way of selecting people for the government. And I felt that really here is a real participation of the public with the government. And the fact that there are so many people from so many various countries and everybody feels that they have an obligation to contribute something, to do something for that, for this. This is a feeling which I never had in Poland. I just lived by day.
Handed a pick and shovel, his first job was digging the new subway, the Independent Line. And later he claimed the station at Broadway and 168th Street was the best in the entire system because of his backbreaking efforts. So began Mike Quill's career in the New York subways. Late one afternoon as he left the hotel, he saw a parade. It was his first parade in New York. It was sponsored by the Socialist Party. And the dignified, work-weary, and anxious men and women marched quietly up Broadway, the message on their hand-printed signs, Free Sacco and Vanzetti. He was witnessing his first American political demonstration, complete with banners and picket signs. He was shocked to learn that the two Italian immigrants had been protesting their innocence for 7 years, denying any connection with the robbery and murder of a paymaster and his guard in South Braintree, Massachusetts. I didn't know an anarchist from a Methodist, he was to remark years later, but the technique of a political frame-up was certainly a commonplace in Irish history. From the day I saw that parade, I hoped those men would be released. I didn't want to believe that America treated political dissenters as the British had done for generations with the hangman's noose of the firing squad. He remembered the night of the execution, and when it was all over, he sensed that America had taken a giant step backwards. I remember that after World War II, when there was another wave of emigration, and the kids started coming over by plane, and it seems that they had two addresses in their pockets, the relative with whom they were going to board, and Mike Quill, the Transport Workers Union, New York City, was usually the way it was addressed. And of course, these communications reached us. And they seemed to think we were an adjunct of either the Irish Consulate or the Department of Labor, I'm not quite sure. But Mike Quill was the man every Irish immigrant kid came to. And Mike's door was open to every one of them. I remember being furious at times when he would just wipe out one appointment after another, and I would sit all day long rescheduling appointments because some kid wandered in off the street with a letter maybe from Mike's cousin or nephew or somebody saying, this is Dan Joe so-and-so, the son of so-and-so from such-and-such a hamlet, all this in the idiomatic references of the community, and he's looking for a job on the buses. And I would say to Mike, well, you could have talked to him for 10 minutes and then sent him to the organizer for the buses, as you would ultimately have to do anyway. But why did you have to sit with him for 3 hours while you canceled appointments with Dubinsky and this one and that one and the other one. And he looked at me and he said, I've never forgotten what it's like to be an immigrant and not know anybody in the city of New York. And I hope I'll never forget. And it's more important to listen to Dan Joe and what happened to the sow or the horse or something else that his grandmother owned. I can see Dubinsky another day.